Hello.
Hello.
Morning, Leonie. Good morning, Graham. Sorry
Good
for
morning.
the delay. There were some maneuvers going on downstairs causing temporary interruption of the signal, but order has been restored, courtesy of Mrs. Trellis's seaweed. Anyway, how go things with you guys?
Well, it's good to know that Mrs. Trellis is in the seaweed.
Yes, it often saves the day at the least aquatic of circumstances, and such was the case with Storm Bert. I was blown to the front door last weekend, I have to say, about 3 a.m. on at least two occasions. Monday wasn't much better, so for taking a short break from the day job, it wasn't the ideal time. It was very Frinton-esque. However, how did you fare, and how did the country fare?
I went to Norfolk of all things. It was insane.
My God, woman. Well, it just
I
happens, doesn't it? If it's in the diary, it's in the diary.
know it was not great for the weather.
Did you manage to
Weather.
find an igloo to cower in?
I was on the beach and it was snowing.
So I saw footage of this, and some people said to me, no, that's just AI. But that's a very London observation, isn't it, really?
No, it was real. It was cold. It was not nice. It was quite weird.
As
Oh, and
Michael
it was,
Flanders once said, there's cold and there's bloody cold.
yeah, and it was horizontal as well because it was so windy.
You're blimey. Well, it's Britain at its best, I suppose. I mean, it's very good for clearing away the cobwebs, not that you have any. Mal, sorry about that. There was a bit of an interruption downstairs. We just started talking about Storm Bert and some statistics. Graham, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just going to up the volume a little bit if I can, guys. Bear with me a second. Hopefully, you were unlike Leonie and myself. You wrapped up warm last weekend.
Me, yeah,
Yeah.
I was probably okay. But it's extraordinary the response of the resilience to the flooding. Seems to be there was someone saying they're perfectly prepared for it and they're expecting it, so they just went and made a cup of tea, you know.
That's it's not what we often hear, is it? There's usually a lot of crying foul about lack of preparedness.
Yeah,
But
I
these
think
aren't
less with
some of the
a
people, these are the doughty Welsh, aren't they, who are in the firing line of this?
the best way to look at it is that global heating just augments all the storms. That's as the temperature goes up, you get more storms. Identifying the proportion of a storm which is due to global warming seems pretty pointless exercise.
Yeah, academical. If, as you say, several parties to whose views you subscribe are saying we've reached the point of no return as previously defined. But Mal, you were saying the stats don't necessarily bear out what Graham's saying.
Well, the stats that I've seen, which I think are based on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, suggest that in terms of storm damage, as a proportion of global GDP, which of course has been rising, but as a proportion of global GDP, storm damage has been falling fairly regularly over the last 100 years. That doesn't mean it's falling in absolute terms, but on the other hand, the amount of damage a storm does in financial terms is to an extent a function of how rich the area was when it was attacked. Because if a storm lands on a relatively undeveloped area in, say, 1930, the damage might be much less than if it's the same storm were to hit the same area 80 years, 90 years later, when it had become much richer and there was a lot more stuff for the storm actually to damage. So it's the stats aren't all that helpful in this. So some evidence. It's still more a matter of saying that these are things we expect to increase in the future than having a great deal of evidence at the moment. And there's just a danger, I think, if we try to over egg the pudding with claiming that all of this is climate change. It opens the door to the skepticism that says, well, there were floods in the 18th century, so all this must be nonsense.
You're talking about resilience and infrastructure, really. Good old, some would say, Balgazette and his drainage plan, which we're still living with, I suppose, aren't we? I'm wondering if this has cropped up on the assembly agenda. There's ever some very interesting debates upcoming this week.
We were talking about AI this week. Sorry, not AI, cyber attacks again this week.
Not
That's
unrelated, really, is it? I mean, in the sense of the potential impact.
the well, we've had this massive cyber attack going on TfL, which I think they then traced to a 14-year-old schoolboy in Walsall or some unbelievable. TfL is ground to a halt. No one could get
Home
hold of
nine,
a,
definitely, yeah.
couldn't get hold of a freedom pass. So, they managed to restore most functionality apart from things that required photos, so zip cards and freedom passes and that sort of thing have only just been restored after several months of not being able to issue them. So I don't know what they're going to quite do about refunding people for journeys, but anyway, I suppose I'll have to try. But yeah, so that came up, and we had part of the meeting was in public, and part of it was actually in private, so that we could dig into more details. I actually missed it because I've not been very well again this week. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
yeah,
Was
no,
that the residue of Norfolk with the snow and all that?
I think it might have been actually, yeah, because I was ill and thought I'd shaken it off, and then it seemed to come back again. So
And now we
odd.
have rumblings of Novovirus the second for the next 48 hours. How they can say 48 hours, I don't know, but that's what they're saying.
Novovirus the second. Wow, that sounds like
Not
quite a,
an obscure potentate of yesteryear, but no.
it sounds like something worth avoiding though.
Well, hopefully, I think you're off to queue, aren't you? I mean, it'll be nice there every there.
But the other thing, of course, that we're coming into the period of time when it takes forever, but starting the sort of first look through all the budget proposals and going through those with a fine tooth comb, and eventually there'll be some finalized rather than draft budgets produced, and then they get signed off during February and March and start from the 1st of April. So there's all that sort of thing going on. I guess that's probably the main thing that's being looked at. And next week the Environment Committee is going to be looking at the mayor's proposal for swimmable rivers, and what does that mean? And is it really something that can happen? So that I guess that will be quite an interesting meeting next week.
No doubt, presumably inspired in part by Anne Hidalgo, the Paris Olympics, and the Seine apparently being quite a lot clearer than once it was. We've been here once or twice, haven't we? And then there's the influence that Graham might want to comment on at some point of Tidemill.
Of what?
Tideway, I think you mean.
Tideway, I beg your pardon, yes.
Was wondering what you were
Yeah.
talking about just for one second there. Yes, Tideway. Well, actually, it was in the mayor's manifesto for the May election. So at that point, obviously, Anne Hidalgo and Paris hadn't had the Olympics happen, or but I guess she must have made her pledge to have the swimming events that were supposed to be in the Seine. She must have pledged it by then. So I don't know which mayor was inspired first, the mayor of London or the mayor of Paris. But having seen how difficult it was, actually, I don't think it's going to be any easier to make the Thames swimmable. And of course, the Thames has got massive tides, and it's quite a tricky river for craft. It's not, it doesn't go down in a straight line, does it? It's got a number
I
of.
well remember in my days as a houseboat owner trying to float this thing down to get on the Grand Union from the upper reaches of the Thames, it was going to be a hairy exercise, timed to the second, if I remember right. They'd get to the lock. This was very tight.
Very good photographs of the Thames in around the 50s, I think, as late as the 50s, where Putney Embankment was being used as a beach, with crowds, sunbathing and swimming in the Thames.
And I suppose that's where the Clean Air Act had sort of been passed then, hadn't it? So it would it's an extraordinary achievement with given the technology of the time, I imagine. Mal, do you have any historical insight into that?
No, I mean, the history, there's an interesting study they were doing at Imperial when I was full time there, looking at the effect of regulation like the Clean Air Act. And the usual evidence is that, or certainly in the case of the Clean Air Act, which was 1956, and it was direct response to the last of the great London smogs that London particulates, as I think they were called in the Sherlock Holmes stories, which had blighted London for 2 centuries, and the last of those in 1952, claims of something like 8,000 deaths from respiratory problems. We'll never know the exact figure, but it's in that sort of ballpark. But actually,
Miles, that's
the
time.
I mean, London was still the vestiges of an industrial city, with manufacturing going on post-war. Now, of course, there's very little manufacturing goes on in London. It's basically a service economy, and its energy needs are different. But the after the war, and you still see echoes of it with the enormous gasometers that we can still see in Battersea and elsewhere across London. The air was actually, I think people had felt this is enough and were already taking the steps to clean up the air before the Clean Air Act came into force. And therefore, actually, what the Clean Air Act did was more of in the nature of formalizing and giving legislative power to processes that were already happening. So the work that was done in Imperial was looking at polluted life cycles and identifying for a lot of pollutants going through, whether it's lead in petrol or sulfur in acid rain or whatever it was, that there's a cycle to most pollutants, that a new process comes along which has very clear benefits, but involves a new industrial process which brings along a new type of pollution. That type of pollution gets established and starts causing problems. People notice this and act on it, and either find ways of mitigating the pollution, or ways or different ways of doing the activity so the pollution doesn't arise in the first place. And then the pollutant begins to die away. We see this with one example I mentioned there, lead in petrol, which at one stage was really quite noticeable and a problem we tend to forget. But now, of course, has gone altogether because we've got other ways of preventing knocking in petrol engines that don't involve using lead. Acid rain's another one where acid rain, the problem of acid rain has very, very much improved in many areas. And the problem with carbon and climate change is that it's not a byproduct of a chemical process industrially, which can be addressed. It's actually a main product. Whenever you burn fossil fuels, however cleanly you do it, you get vast amounts of carbon dioxide produced. And so, unfortunately, carbon hasn't followed this, or certainly in the same timescales, hasn't followed this life cycle, whereby now we'd expect its levels to be falling significantly. Unfortunately, carbon levels have continued to rise very, very precipitately globally ever since the Rio Convention, and of course before.
Yeah, indeed. I suppose the nature of coal mining economic cycles across the globe. What you're saying in general does seem to be a very optimistic about the cycle of innovation and the sort of imperatives at ground level and almost the redesign of London, post-war, post-industrially. I wonder if there are echoes here, certainly in terms of the economics that Leone was talking about earlier on, that are being planned even now, the assembly for next year, of what's going on in, well, various war zones. I mean, the reconstruction of Ukraine, it is with or without Elon Musk, presumably with now, is sort of in abeyance. We have a ceasefire in the Lebanon, a country that's been on its knees economically, and an army on its knees economically, their own, being brought in to sort of adumbrate this ceasefire, and the at least partial collapse of the ruble, the Gazprom bank. So I dare say people are saying with Putin there's an element of manipulation going on here.
Well, apparently the Russian economy will collapse next year if the Ukrainians can carry on for another year.
Why?
The military bubble will burst because when Trump comes in, he can lower the price of oil, so it's it collapses the Russian economy. He, meanwhile, is bombing solar panels in Ukraine as well as fossil fuel and nuclear plants.
Yeah, they've
So
gone for the power plants again, haven't they, in the latest salvo? Yeah.
it's
Putin,
becoming
not
yeah.
Putin, not Trump. Trump's not bombing anyone in Ukraine, is he? Sorry, I'm getting confused.
Well, there will be a lot of
Well, no doubt
confusion.
he is too. But you're doing so in a rather more erudite way.
I don't know about
He
erudite,
will be
but still.
coordinating with Putin as to how to make the best deal on on Ukraine.
Oh, well, probably he seems to, I think he could do anything, really, couldn't he?
Well, he could make a good deal for American military equipment, which they can then start selling to Ukraine rather than giving it.
Well,
And ask Europe, asking Europe to pay, for example.
yeah, could do that. I thought his announcement about tariffs this week was interesting.
What was that?
It's alternative facts economically, so I would say.
The tariffs seem to be linked not so much to trade issues, but to he announced that two of America's closest trading partners, Canada and Mexico, with whom they actually have a particular deal. He announced that he was going to apply sanctions to Canada and Mexico unless they stop the flow of immigrants into America over the borders into the states and also stop the flow of fentanyl, which is so it's not a trade war, it's very much a transactional punishment for you doing these things to us.
You start with the particularly with the fentanyl with the idea of a conspiracy theory there, I guess by implication only, whereas this is an organized alternative economy. We find it very, very presently, as you'll know, Lee, only on the streets of London, with daily updates, kind of the NHS.
Yeah,
More and more.
I don't think there's anywhere near as much fentanyl anywhere else in the world as there is in the States. And of course, the precursor chemicals are made in China. So it's going to be interesting to see how the use of tariffs might be brought in against the Chinese, not just because they've been supplying cheap goods into American markets, which obviously Trump has this America First line. So you should buy American goods, not Chinese goods. But if he's going to use
American
tariffs against,
fentanyl. Yeah.
he's going to use tariffs against Mexico and Canada for the final products coming over the border from, from the north and from the south into the states, then presumably he might use tariffs against China, not just for the to stop the import of Chinese goods, but also to say, you haven't done anything about the labs that are making these precursor chemicals.
Yeah,
So,
I suppose the implication is, I mean, to as it were, to play devil's advocate here, what if all this were legalized, and is it effectively covertly a weapon of war, a weapon of economic war?
it's clearly a weapon. Otherwise,
Was against China when Britain did it against China in the Opium Wars.
yeah. It's clearly a weapon.
Sanitary reminder there.
Yeah,
Because in the
exactly.
end, you are wreaking havoc on the infrastructure and the human resilience of a population, aren't you?
Well, the situation in America is quite unbelievable in certain places, yeah. So I think it is a weapon of some sort of, and yes, I mean the British were disgraceful with the Opium Wars. It was really really, really very unpleasant.
Use of tariffs will push Europe towards China. So America could lose out
There
on
was
trade.
historically, wasn't there? Sorry, you were saying, yeah.
Yeah, trade. I was just saying tariffs is a very difficult thing to control
Yeah, I was going to
because
say,
there's
there was
foreign.
historically. I mean, I think there's a matter of record the CIA was involved in the introduction of certain street drugs into the housing projects in places like Watts, affecting the black community back there. So you have an instrument potentially there of political control. I suppose this leads us in a roundabout way, Mal, to consider, well, I suppose the future of modern warfare, given the exponential cost of all these things. And the fact that, well, there must be some reason why this, beyond peace and love, that this Lebanon ceasefire has been introduced where it has. Is that a matter of the supply chain, V-Day, also the Russian economy?
Well, I think the timing of the Lebanese ceasefire is all to do with the American election, I suspect. Well, that's the main factor there. That Biden has been, rattling the saber a bit more against Israel recently, whereas Trump is making very clear that reinforcements are on the way, and that as soon as he's in power, he'll be supporting Israel far more vigorously than Biden Harris, who were always
If that were
rather
possible. Yeah,
they're
isn't it?
ambivalent on it. And so, is it any coincidence that it was a 60-day ceasefire, 58 days before Trump takes over the presidency again? Israel seemed to be making some reasonable inroads into the Hezbollah infrastructure in the south of Lebanon. It's just utterly extraordinary that there's a UN agency whose whole job was to prevent Hamas from sorry Hezbollah from developing these weapons, who have just sat by and watched it in much the same way as the UNRWA has been funding the most dreadful educational programs, training girls and children to view Jews as dogs, and their main job in life is to kill Jews.
Really? Yeah, can you give me a citation on that, Mal? That's very
Yes, there's
concerning
been
and
quite a bit.
surprising.
There's quite a few examples now which have been smuggled out. You can get them on the web quite easily, and also interviews with children. There's been a couple in the last 2 days on X, which quite
Yeah,
easy
can't be Elon
to
Musk, but yeah,
find,
sure. Yeah.
of children being interviewed as to what they're taught in school. And saying this now, of course, there's always the caveat that you've got to be aware of deep fakes in these circumstances. But it doesn't seem that anybody in UNRWA has denied that this is going on.
Well, they're not there anymore, are they, really? I mean, yeah.
So the UN. And I find it just very odd that the UN is, or the international courts, is issuing address warrants for Netanyahu, but not for Erdogan and for Assad and those around the world who have, caused far more deaths in the last year than the whole Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East has seen in its 75 years. So I think there's a sense that Netanyahu doesn't want to rock the boat in the dying days of the Biden presidency, and is taking Trump at his word that things will change when the Trump is in the White House.
Well,
So I
he's
don't
still
read
culpable,
too
isn't he, for those war charges and things? I mean, he's not off the hook, you know. Yeah.
well. There's a lot of there's a I'm not sure how clear these things are. I mean
That's
the
Trump also, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
The I mean, if we're talking about Trump, I mean, those charges will evaporate and are already beginning to do so, I suspect,
The
because
court has made a
certainly.
very interesting ruling that they've suspended all actions against Trump with the possibility of review. So it's just going to bypass. You can't
So I have to stay in office in perpetuity, rather like perhaps one Vlad Putin and potentially, I suppose, one B. Netanyahu.
Yes, but he can't
No,
forgive himself when he's hasn't got against him.
Graham, they're not dismissing all of the charges. Some of them,
Not
some,
dismissing, they're suspending them.
no,
Well, the federal.
some have been dismissed and some have, the sentencing has been suspended, but quite a few have already been dismissed. So it's a sort of, I mean, basically they're not, I think even the one that's suspended will be dismissed as soon as he takes office. And that's the one where he was convicted in the hush money trial. And I think the woman who's just made the Attorney General nominee was one of his lawyers in the hush money trial. So I'm fairly sure once she actually becomes the Attorney General, she will dismiss that charge.
There has been this rush, hasn't there, to
Yes,
get a
that's the point
Democrat on the bench before their term expires.
of suspending them, is that they can't be dismissed until he's no longer president. I mean, he's got something like 350 cases against him.
Yeah, but most of those have started to be dismissed. Some are being dismissed. That's what
Could
I'm
they be
saying.
over time reformulated in different ways?
No, I don't think you can retry for the same crime. Double jeopardy? I don't
Of
think you can
course, it
do that.
assumes his term in office is going to be completely blameless, rather unlike the last one.
Well, some of the charges were at state level and some were at federal level. And
Yeah,
I think the Trump
good point.
administration has much less influence over the state cases. So they may continue, but it does look as if the federal ones are bit by bit beginning to evaporate.
Well, let's pause that for a moment. I suppose, only in a very noirish way, linkable, but the assisted dying bill is coming before the Commons today. So I think, is it an early day motion? Private members bill, I beg your pardon. Courtesy of backbencher Kim Ledbetter, Esther Ranson, poor lady, and some other people who are saying now is the time to reconsider. The proposals are that, let's think, we've got two doctors and a judge, two sort of a reviewable decision after 7 days, at least 7 days, on the part of the potentially terminating party. Does this offend you morally? Do you think now's the time, given the volubility of the rest of life, that we look at this again in a more, perhaps more realistic way?
Yeah, I'm pessimistic about it. It seems completely the wrong time to introduce some legal killing law legislation.
Why do you say that?
Well, people want other people killed. Is a very common situation in families or in budgets or for all sorts of reasons. And it would increase paranoia against hospitals. You wouldn't want to go into a hospital if you thought the doctors or the hospital had a may have a legal way of killing you.
Just down the road here, May Day Hospital was known apocryphally as May Die Hospital. I'm sure unfairly, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's even the word assisted dying, is completely against the
Not like
Hippocratic Oath.
this. No, Mrs. Trellis is saying not assisted shower. No, let's not go there. No, okay.
It's interesting the way the priesthood is coming out against it. So it's against the sacredness of life. It is a slippery slope. I mean, once you've crossed the barrier, I mean, in any case, there are ways. I mean, my father was assisted in dying by being given control over the heroin pump, and it was perfectly. And it's, I went to a celebration of someone's life who went to Switzerland, and
What was the
they.
general consensus on that, Graham? Obviously, the mood is, I'm sure, beatific and convivial, but it's a thing, isn't it?
Well.
It's becoming a thing.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was, perfectly in acceptance. Everyone accepted, and they all praised the woman for what she'd done with her life. You know, she had an amazing life.
My God, it must
So,
be a moment, mustn't it? A matter of life and death, as it were, in the modern age.
I mean, the husband, I don't think, was still in enormous pain.
Yeah.
So I don't think, and her friends as well, so it doesn't get rid of the pain for the rest of the people.
Leonie, this is going to sound, I don't want to sound sexist or chauvinist anyway. In that one half of the human equation is cardinally, wonderfully responsible for bringing life onto the planet. Is there a broadly feminist view of this, or am I completely up the wrong chute there?
Not that I'm aware of. I can't say I've researched whether there's a feminist angle on this. What I have done is
What's
looked at,
your sort of gut feeling on this?
well, I have looked at the details of what she's trying to introduce, Leadbeater. And my problem with it is that it's for terminally ill people who've got a diagnosis of 6 months to live. And I think we must all know somebody who's been given a diagnosis of 6 months to live,
You know,
who's
my
then,
landlady was given it 30 years ago.
well, exactly. And I think 6 months isn't end of life for a start off. And we know far too many people who've been given that diagnosis and have then lived a lot longer than 6 months. So I think that is actually far too long. I think if it was end of life, 3 months to live, I mean, we all know people who've died slowly and right at the very end in that last few months have, then lived with incredible pain but are very close to death. And I think in those very, very, very final moments, you could possibly consider allowing the person themselves to administer something. But of course,
As
then
Graham
that
was saying there with his dad, yeah.
it only becomes, it's only possible for those people, which then means that there's other people who, can't administer anything, who may also be in pain. So that then is still discriminatory. But I don't think you could possibly extend it so that other people administer something. That really would just be killing. And my other problem, with it, apart from that, is, obviously, we need to be reducing the number of people who are living in horrible pain towards the end of their life. So we need to be making sure there's really good palliative care, and we need to make sure that there is hospices that people can go to where people are really skilled and knowledgeable about palliative care. And we're not funding hospices. Hospices all over the country are on the brink of collapse and are closing.
Are they really?
Yes, they are, because we
That's
don't, they're not
a
funded.
shocking thing to discover.
They're not funded at all. People are not funded to go into them. They're funded through charity fundraising. So there's a really big hospice not far from where I live, which I've visited on many occasions. It's absolutely beautiful. I was there actually this time last year, because they were running workshops on how to have a good death, but as a sort of an outreach actually, which was very interesting.
The doula and all that, yeah.
Trinity Hospice is on the brink of closure as well. So, it's ridiculous for us to be debating assisted dying at a point where, the Chancellor has just announced billions of pounds extra to go into the health service, has announced almost nothing extra to go to local authorities and adult social care, a very, very small amount of money extra announced, which is going to be completely eaten up with the increase in the living wage for any staff who are paid at that level who work in hospices, and of course completely taken up by the employer's national insurance, which is why some of them are now on the brink of going bust. So rather than spending parliamentary time debating assisted dying, surely we should be trying to fix how hospices are about to be, die themselves all over the country. I mean, it is, we need hospices where people can die with dignity, where people who know how to administer really good palliative care can help people to make sure that there are as few people as possible dying in pain. And there are, revolutionary ways now of treating pain in many cases. But we're not doing that. So talking about assisted dying in that context, I think, is completely wrong. And I actually hope that the MPs vote this down. And I've conducted some discreet and private inquiries with friends of mine who are Labour MPs. And I think quite a lot of the people who haven't come out publicly are planning to vote against this, but they really do need to put money into a really good network of hospices, must be properly funded, and we must have properly funded palliative care. We shouldn't be considering this. It's putting the cart very much before the horse.
You make such a powerful point. We have, it's not called that anymore, the Home for the Incurables, don't we, in Putney? And that's rebranded. I'm wondering if there isn't sort of political correctness in the sense that these people can have some kind of a viable life, hopefully, with, as you say, expert care, is one thing. But at the same time, if it is it brushing the issue under the carpet, effectively? And
Well, the
Merrill,
people,
what do you make of Leone's point there about putting much more money into end-of-life care?
well, just on the
Right, yeah.
that's the Putney Hospital for people with neuro
Neuro
disabilities,
disability, yes, yeah.
and they would not be within the scope of this bill at all
My
because
apologies. I was thinking about that, what used to be called
they're
a state of, a palliative viability, but only just.
A vegetative state. No, these are people with neuro disabilities who, in many cases, have had accidents, who are actually undergoing incredible rehabilitation. If you ever visit the hospital on
Very
Putney
important
Hill,
distinction, thank you.
and so they're not terminally ill. They're very damaged, but many of them are undergoing incredible rehabilitation, actually.
I
So,
guess I made it in a rather cack-handed way, but there's an
yeah,
institution that hasn't received much public money, but
no.
that has achieved some extraordinary things and the advances
Yes.
in people's potential. But that investment, or that drive towards investment from whatever source hasn't, as you so helpfully say, reached end-of-life care.
No, they're not terminally ill at all.
No, thank you for making that distinction. I think people
Little
might have
known,
sort of written them off quite wrongly.
Little
I know
known
what you were
fact,
saying.
political nightmare. I mean, you can imagine if it came in. I mean, the stories that then start coming out about how people are arguing about staying alive, and they're having these arguments. They're dying, trying to argue that they should live, which is already happening in hospitals.
Some people, I mean, the contrary argument that some people have, I think I heard it at some point towards the latter stages of my own parents' lives, it was heartbreaking to hear, was that they didn't want to be a burden. They were anything but,
Well, this is where I think this is where for me, I think the most concerning thing is that at the moment, the assumption is that while assisted dying isn't a thing, then anybody who's going into hospital simply doesn't face the internal pressure of should I be asking for assisted dying here because I'm maybe a burden. As soon as you introduce that
oh, a huge
possibility,
pain.
then everybody is faced with that question that they simply weren't faced with before the option was there. Everyone's faced with the question, well, should I be opting for assisted suicide? And I'd say one of the sickest things I've seen recently is these dreadful advertisements that have gone up in the tube and
A
elsewhere
bit bizarre, wasn't it? Yeah,
of,
yeah.
very cheerful. So, and interestingly, all white. Very few adverts on the tube show white people, but these are
Exclusively.
all white people. I think that itself is very interesting. But all these cheerful, joyful young people saying, in effect, yippee, I won't put if I'm in a terminal state, I won't put my family through having to watch me die. Well, if anything is going to exacerbate the sense that people are going to feel an obligation to protect their family from the effects of their dying. This seems aimed at doing precisely that. And when we've got dozens of suicides on the tube, tragically, every year, big adverts going up saying you really ought to think seriously about killing yourselves in certain circumstances. It's one of the most irresponsible and dreadful things I've seen. And I just cannot see how possibly the Tube, which has banned some very, very ordinary adverts over the last 2 or 3 years, has suddenly allowed this grotesque, appalling advertisement or set of advertisements to go around. And actually, I have to say, there are very strong arguments from very good people on both sides of this. And I do absolutely see the argument of saying that if someone is simply in dreadful pain and they no longer have the personal capacity to do anything about it, then I can understand the argument of saying that it's a kindness to them to help them out of their
Yeah,
misery
there's the key
when,
word, I guess.
yeah, and so you know, it's not black and white by any means. There are arguments on both sides, but the moment when I, you know, was clear in my own mind that I don't support this measure was when I saw these advertisements. I thought they encapsulated all of the fears around this. And bearing in mind, you know, we've got a health service where we've just locked a nurse up for murdering many, many children.
The Letchley case, still the smoking gun, it has to be said,
The bill as it stands says there can be no civil action taken against a doctor who takes part in assisted suicide or whatever the term being used is. So the bill itself, actually, as it stands, specifically excludes anyone being prosecuted for malpractice in the course of carrying this out.
Well,
The
Harold
cover
Shipman, I
that this
suppose, comes to mind
gives,
there.
yeah, the cover that this particular bill, so there's the two issues, there's the principle and then there's the appalling speed with which this is being rushed through Parliament, where, you know, MPs will be given perhaps 30 seconds to speak on a single day, a single day's debate. There's a lot of detail in the bill, which I think is extremely worrying, not least this, which would give, you know, for those who are, you know, fortunately, a tiny minority, but those who are badly motivated, but the rather larger number who take an argument, you know, that end-of-life care is expensive, and if we can reduce the amount we're spending on end-of-life care, we've got money to spend elsewhere. This bill really does give a lot of cover for that. And I've found, having been, you know, genuinely undecided on this, or probably tending towards the supporting side, and I find myself really very, very worried indeed by this whole process.
I wonder, Graham, if the optics of that ad weren't intended as a sort of covert irony that
Well,
people
I
might be
think
so
it's
shocked by this, they might go, you know, they might, as Mal has eloquently put it, think, hang on a minute.
yeah, I think there's a kind of symmetry with the arguments against hanging. You know, it's the effect on the whole society that countries are legalizing killing. And there's just no way of getting around that. And arrangements and in practice, hospitals are helping people to die painlessly and finding ways to do it within the present law. So
That
I
in
think it's much.
itself is extraordinary skill embodied, and of course, the wisdom of your father being
Yeah.
empowered.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a very good death. I mean, there was no bad feeling at all, you know.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Yeah, so I'm completely, the more I talk about it, the more I'm against it, you know, on principle. It's just an impossible thing to do legally.
I
You
think with
cannot
you three, I
you
mean,
cannot.
you know, yeah, your experience is broad enough, I think, unlike some parliamentarians, no names, no pack drill, to actually make an informed judgment on this, but given all the variables.
And the mistakes they made on the farming legislation, for instance, you know, it doesn't give any hope at all for that this would be done effectively.
Yes, there have been some contrary arguments about the likes of Ron Clarkson, haven't there, since about the fact that it's designed to stop people buying land as a tax dodge. Not that we wish to accuse him of doing that, but it's a potential stratagem, isn't it? So
He's
checks and balances all the way.
He's the farmer's worst advocate, I think.
Just to move on to a more, I suppose, vivacious topic, and there'll be a lot of political energy expended this afternoon, and this thing is perhaps briefly heard. Last Saturday morning, I found myself windblown, I'm delighted to say, into a meeting of Tooting Transition Towns. It's a national movement, and I noted that in terms of the sort of more, far more than pipe dreams for Tooting in 2040, some eight local councillors have been in attendance at the first station. It's all about people power and building hubs, and I thought about the extent of the voluntary sector in our corner of Southwest London, and whether you feel that there is a legitimate tier of democracy formable from how these guys operate. Have you had any brush with this movement?
Yeah, of course. I know Transition Town Tooting and Transition Town Wandsworth, and have
There's
had
one there too, is there? Oh, I didn't know.
yeah, no, there's loads of them all over the place. It was Rob Hopkins, and the whole concept of transition was based on their interpretation that we'd reached what they called peak oil, which I don't think is true because.
This is
So
not
I think
about oiling your Pekingese, is
no, it's not.
it?
It was
No,
about we'd reached the peak level of oil usage in our economies, and also the peak level of oil extraction. And I think that it has been completely wrong because I don't think any of them were geologists who came up with this concept. And
that's
of
often the
course,
problem, isn't it?
there is a lot more oil out there. It's just that when it hasn't reached a certain price, it's uneconomic to extract it from certain places. So before the 1970s, it wasn't worth extracting the oil from the North Sea because it's quite difficult. It's a long way down. It's much more expensive to take it out of the North Sea than it is to stick an oil derrick in the ground where it's in sand, inches below the surface. So you've got all those incredible pictures from the 1920s and 30s in Texas, for example, where every 2 yards there's another oil derrick, and oil is being pumped up all over the place.
Close one in which farm am I all stamping around at Dorset recently? I think that's on in mothballs because it was very effective and suddenly it wasn't.
That's a slightly longer
Anyway, sorry.
discussion.
Yeah, you
Longer
were saying.
discussion about. I mean, they've been extracting. There used to be a flare at Fawley where they were extracting gas for years and years and years, and there is oil under various parts here, Studland Bay and round
Yeah.
there. But there are issues about why.
Special scientific interest.
Yeah, that's right. So of course now it has become viable to squeeze oil out of. I mean, there are massive reserves of oil in oil shales, in rock, whereas before it wasn't economic to squeeze it out of rock.
The Trump card next to time round.
That's right. And so we haven't reached peak oil, and there is still plenty of oil. And so fracking has now become a thing, whereas nobody ever talked about fracking 10 years ago because it just wasn't viable. Economically, to spend all the amount of money that you had to remove it, and also the degree of energy that had to be expended to remove the extract this source of energy. But all of that has continued. So in one sense, the Transition Town movement has kind of gone off the boil a bit, but in a few places it became very very popular. For example, in Totnes in Devon, wasn't that was it
Dartington,
was a real sort of hotbed of it, and there was a whole movement. They held a big conference at the Battersea Arts Centre in 2015, I think it was, when and they invited Ed Miliband when he was the leader of the opposition, and of course had previously been the first Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change when DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, was a thing. He was the first Secretary of State there, under Gordon Brown, when he was the Prime Minister between 2007 and 10. And of course, we now see Mr. Miliband is back again
Yeah.
as the Secretary of State. So it's kind of kept on trucking the transition town movement. It's just not been as prominent. There are a few people in Tooting who've been very assiduous in keeping it alive, and they've done some really interesting community engagement events, and they also hold workshops where people are trained in how to repair things to sort of
That's their
move.
big suit at the moment. Yes, indeed. That was happening over at the URC in Tooting on Saturday.
So rather than you go to a shop, you buy it, and then when it breaks, you chuck it in the bin, and then you go to the shop and buy something else. So it's a very sort of linear economy of buy, use, chuck in a straight line. It's more about having that more circular economy, which is why one of the reasons why I got involved in Wandsworth Oasis, apart from the fact that they give money to good causes, but obviously
Yeah, terrific. Yeah.
they run
Alma
charity
mater.
shops.
Yeah.
They run charity shops all over Wandsworth, and have got a couple outside of Wandsworth as well, in Lambeth and Islington, where people bring in stuff that otherwise they might be chucking away, and it's pre-loved and is then resold to other people. And of course, if you've got a cost of living crisis, there's a lot of people coming through the door of charity shops at the moment, because you can buy a, for example, we're just entering the winter, you can buy a winter coat in an Oasis charity shop that might be worth £250
Completely rewired, yeah.
if you were buy, well, not so much rewiring a coat, but you can buy things at a fraction of the cost if you were going to go and buy the same item brand new. So I think all these things are a good way of moving away from this sort of terribly wasteful approach that we have of either things end up in holes in the ground, which they did. We've got landfill sites all over the place, or as we've now moved on to much more, we don't send them to landfill, but we do send them to incineration.
Yeah,
So
which
if
we've
when,
historically not been very good at.
yeah, we're we've got incinerators all over. There's about six or seven that serve London now, and most of London's r rubbish. So over 50% of London's rubbish is now burnt. So if you chuck it in the bin, in the black bag, rather than
And
in the
not always next to
recycling.
Brian Risk calls it, has to be said.
So, there's th so Transition Town has still got a very strong point, I think,
It's
that
evolved then.
we're
It's an
interesting. We're
Matt.
wasteful.
When I was at Imperial, there was a sustainable cities project running in the next office to mine. I used to go in and learn some fascinating stuff from them. But their conclusions were that actually recycling and incineration have roughly the same environmental footprints and are roughly equivalent. Reduction of waste is by far the best way of dealing with waste, and not to
Oh,
produce
of
it in the first
course.
place.
Of course.
Reuse is by far the second best
Yeah,
if you've made
absolutely.
something, then and I think we're all agreed with that. But then
Yeah.
recycling and incineration, as long as your incineration, as with the Wandsworth uses an incinerator at Belvedere in on the river in East London,
Oh, yeah.
so the waste is taken down the river, which is a relatively
My barge.
environmentally friendly way of doing it. Yes, on these big barges you see around Smugglers Way and down there. And then it does displace fossil fuel use for electricity generation. And that seems to be in terms of, because recycling, we should be careful about thinking that recycling is always a good thing. Recycling of metal cans is clearly a very, very good idea, because you're not having to put all of the energy in that you do to make the metal in the first place. It's ready made. You're simply melting it down and reusing it. The case around things like recycling glass as opposed to reusing bottles, there's no resource implication. I guess it takes a bit of strain off the world's sand reserves. But it's
The
but
world
when it
sand
comes to
reserves.
glass plants we can in Norfolk,
I don't think the world sand reserves are under great threat from
no, exactly. Well,
scarcity.
Miss is wagging her finger. Where do you put your seaweed,
And
lovely? Thank you.
but
Recycle your paper.
Malcolm, that's why those of us who work in this field and have been trying to encourage the previous government, and certainly will encourage the current government as well, that's why we've been talking about EPS, End Producer Responsibility, and DRS, deposit return schemes, So that you are recycling the actual bottle rather than
Yeah.
chucking it into a recycling bag. And all over the whole of Europe, if you take your bottles back to the supermarket, you'd have a reverse vending situation where you put them into a machine that then assesses the bottles and very carefully takes them in and doesn't break them, and they then get washed out and reused.
That's very clever.
And you then get some money back from the machine in the supermarket. So guess what? Every time someone goes to the supermarket, they take a bag full of all the bottles that they've got that need to go back. We've just
That
been
we used to do with the Corona
so.
bottles as kids.
That's right.
You
They
know,
used
samples back,
and
didn't
they
you?
are. They've been talking about introducing a deposit return scheme for so long, it's ridiculous, and they just need to bloody well get on with it.
Well, yeah, I remember just leaving milk bottles out for the milkman to
Yeah,
collect once
exactly.
we'd used them.
Exactly. Anyway, listen, guys, it's been great talking to you, but I am going to have to go because I'm off to Kew Gardens this morning to,
Are you planting something?
I might be, but it's to talk about tree planting and biodiversity and all sorts of things. So
We
it's
wish we
been.
were there. Can you report back
Have a
next
good
week?
day.
I will, and have a good one yourselves.
Have a lovely time and a great
Okay.
weekend. Thanks, Leonie. Graham, could I turn to you about the transition towns movement? Some people would say that this is sort of, I don't know, to be devil's advocate for a minute, do-gooding, and a cosmetic exercise, a bit vainglorious. That's not what they say. Is this a significant plank, however, in terms of palpable public investment in a greener future?
Well, that's exactly the word. I think it's the most significant regeneration movement. It's a public participation opportunity for everyone, and is having great impact worldwide. Michael Bloomberg got involved with this years ago
Did you
in
really?
transitioning New York house by house.
Is
so
that
I
like, so is that continuing? Because we think of those, you know, the green bridges in the Bronx and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
It's in evidence there, isn't it?
there's a, I think it's an organization called CAC 40, where it's the collaboration between cities around the world on for renewable energy. We should mention that the name I used in the case on the Thames Tunnel was Blue Green London Plan. For exactly the planning of transition cities, including London. So I think it's something that the public can get involved in preference to protesting, like Just Stop Oil, for instance.
Yeah.
They put
So
the
effectively, you know, it's the public teaming with some, no doubt, skills and trainability, teaming with you guys as scientists.
Well, it's something that you can do before government, and you can then persuade government to get involved and fund it.
Do
So,
you like the sound of that, Mel?
Yeah, so it's always been the way, one of the arguments around the effect Trump will have on climate change technology in the States is that actually, yeah, certainly the federal government can set a tone, but by definition, you know, work tends to be done on the ground, and the position of the individual states was always at least as important as the federal government when it came to what was going on. So with all of these things, it's yeah, recognizing the national governments or federal governments do have a role to play in this, but actually innovation tends to grow from the ground up rather than from the government down.
Well, last time the environment agency, like the education agency, again in Trump's sights as last time, was either wound down or all completely abolished, wasn't it? Or put in mothballs.
Yeah, and there's no, if you were to just get a graph of US carbon emissions, say, over the last 20 or 30 years, you would not be able to, just by looking at that single graph, you would have no idea whatsoever whether it was Democrat or Republican in the White House. The curve, sadly, you know, it's been an upward one. But you can't detect. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Clinton and Gore, and Gore was the great environmental vice president, who's going to be the great environmental president. They didn't ratify the Kyoto Protocol. They signed it, but
I know.
they never ratified it.
Clint has just published a memoir, hasn't he? Yeah. Doesn't
And
mention
the
that at
US
all.
was never, the US was never fully part of that, despite all the rhetoric coming out of the Clinton-Gore White House.
It's presumed it's the Eminence Grise kind of funding them, isn't it? Very often, people used to weigh in about the influence of the trade unions on labor politics, but the corporate lobbying in terms of the achievement of the election to certain people, would be, and the people behind Trump's election, of course, are very much in the shadows for one reason or another. It's a thing, isn't it? So, however liberal your consciousness may appear, it's what you can't say.
Well, I think it's where you put your money.
Yeah, indeed, yes.
Instead of subsidizing oil industry, which is still over the trillions, it's worth bearing in mind that in the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, that was done by the misallocation of capital. It's just what we pay for. We can buy the solutions to global warming. And it's now it's simply a question of how much money we put in as to how fast we transition.
How
You know,
often
so
do people like
there's no
Gorbachev
excuse.
compare America to ancient Rome?
Putin is destroying his own civilization. You know, he's committed suicide for Russia in destroying the economy. It's definitely the fossil industry against the world.
That's a heady thought on which to pause for now, isn't it? I think the jury's out, I suppose, on Russia over the next 12 months. But he's going to have a bit of a job containing insurrection as if it comes. Can you see that coming down the pike now?
I'm not an expert on the Russian economy. I don't know what's the long-term prospects are. My suspicion is that they must have taken a very considerable battering over Ukraine, and whatever the outcome there, I'd have thought their capacity for expansionism, which is Russia, Putin has made no bones about. His idea is to try and redevelop not only the Soviet Union but the whole Soviet bloc.
I was going to say, grab a bit more land and you're home and dry, but he's not there yet, is he?
No, and there are, it'll be, we're in a phase where, I mean, we're in a very dangerous phase of the whole war at the moment with the very clear escalation, justified, but allowing US missiles to be fired into Russia is an escalation of the whole situation. But if at any point we should bear in mind, when Putin goes, what comes in could well be worse. We need to be very careful about retaining, or being aware of the possibility of further escalation if someone even more hawkish were to take over at the Kremlin. But generally, I've got no inside knowledge about this. I don't understand the state of affairs in Russia, and until I do feel more about it, I don't really think it's anybody speculating on it.
Well, indeed. Well, let's see what the next week brings. I don't think I'd be doing a disservice to the many of the women of Tooting if I compare them speculatively to the babushkas on both sides of the equation over there. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. See you next time. Have a great weekend.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Bye.